Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Apple's new CEO, Tim Cook, has touched down in China, reportedly to meet with government officials there. His trip comes just days after the company published the results of a probe by the Fair Labor Association on working conditions in Chinese-owned factories where popular devices like iPads are assembled. And it's just weeks after writer and performer Mike Daisy was forced to admit that he made up some of the events, sites, and people he met in China while researching his monologue, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. Daisy, in his own defense, says that his work conveyed truths about conditions that journalists do not cover. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz, who's been reporting in China for years, exposed Daisy's lies. Schmitz was asked whether correspondents in China were indeed reporting the truth about what goes on in the colossal factories that have made China a global industrial power. Schmitz noted several excellent reporters and books, including Factory Girls by Leslie T. Chang. We spoke to Chang, who spent a decade in China as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal when the book first came out. Of the 130 million migrants working in factories in China, about 70% of them are young women. It's an entire generation of girls who leave rural villages and traditional families behind for the chance to make about $100 a month. In a work that is certifiably nonfiction, Chang followed a few of those ambitious factory girls as they jumped from one job to the next in search of better wages and better lives. They live by their wits, acute self-preservation skills, and mistrust of virtually everyone. Her book takes place mostly in the giant factory city of Duanggan on the Pearl River in the south of China. She calls it a place without memory.
One of the really striking things about reporting in a factory town like Duanggan is that life seems to be lived minute by minute. And even for people who've been in the city for a couple years and have gone through incredible changes, you never heard anyone say, well, I've come a long way since I came out from home, or my life has changed a lot. There seemed to be no sense of kind of taking stock or seeing where someone came from. Everyone was so focused on the day-to-day, you know, improving their lives day by day, saving up a bit more money, climbing a bit higher on the job ladder to even think about anything that had come before.
Well, about a third of the 130 million migrants are women. They are often younger than their male counterparts, more likely single. They travel farther to get to their destination jobs and stay away longer. What is the typical path for a female migrant? You know, what kind of conditions do they live by?
Well, they mostly come out from home when their education is finished, which usually means after middle school, or maybe for the slightly luckier ones, a bit of high school. They'll come out to the city, usually introduced by a family friend or relative or fellow villager to work in a factory. And usually the first factory they work in has really terrible conditions because they know very little about the city and they're just kind of going in blind. But, you know, that's not where their story ends, because after they work in the factory for a little bit, they start hearing, oh, this factory is better, this factory has better wages, the boss is nicer, the dorms are cleaner. And so they'll often jump, you know, to another factory and then maybe have a succession of jumps until they find a place that they're satisfied with. And longer term, it varies. You know, my sense is that the more successful women will eventually end up marrying and living in the city of Duanggan and just becoming kind of middle-class urban people. And probably the less successful, the less ambitious, will maybe move back to their home areas, but not their villages, you know, not to the farms, but probably to like a county seat or a city near their village and do some kind of small-scale business there. So they're really leaving the farm behind for good.
Well, you meet many young women over the 2 years of research, but you focus on the story of two. Let's start with Lu Qingmin, or she's called Min throughout the book. She leaves her village for the first time to find a job totally unprepared. She has no resume, not even a pen to fill out an application, but says she accepts a job because a woman smiled at her. Much of this book is about the loneliness, that sort of looking for connection that these women feel.
Yeah, it's an incredibly lonely experience, and it's hard for us to understand, I think, because we grow up in America in a pretty individual kind of environment, but for these young women, they've always lived in communal environments where they've known everyone. You know, they grew up in a farming village where they knew, not only knew everyone, but probably were related to almost everyone. And then after that, they go to school where, again, it's people from nearby villages, people they've known all their lives. And then suddenly they're living in a city of, you know, 8 or 10 million people where they don't know a soul. And the fact that there are so many people around them kind of accentuates their loneliness. So one of the things I noticed about reporting among these young women was how guarded they were. Mm. You know, they made friends very cautiously. They were very careful about their privacy. They didn't want people to know their personal details, very wary of gossip and rumors and bad reputations floating around. So that was kind of the first lesson for these young women is this incredible self-preservation instinct that will help them live in this, you know, giant city of strangers.
Well, relying on the self is kind of a mantra for them. We see it over and over again. There are magazines and a huge self-improvement industry that's kind of preying on their ambitions.
That's right. It's a really ruthless world. And, you know, I had very mixed feelings reporting there because on the one hand, I feel like it's an opportunity for these young people to leave the countryside, especially for the young women, to get away from very traditional patriarchal ideas and low expectations for young women, basically. But at the same time, as you say, it's incredibly ruthless, exploitative world. And yet, these young women find ways to help themselves, to try to improve themselves, to rise up from the factory floor. And as you mentioned, one of the ways is there are just, you know, so many of these commercial classes and self-improvement books and magazines. And they're really fascinating. It's sort of like a vision of globalization because a lot of these young women are reading, you know, Benjamin Franklin's 10 Rules for Behavior or, you know, Lee Iacocca's Keys to Success, you know, like all these sort of bizarre, slightly outdated American ideas. And yet they're sort of applying it to a very Chinese context. So you also have, you know, kind of these Confucian sort of ideas built in, like, you know, if you succeed, you will raise up your whole family for three generations. You know, that's a very Chinese idea. So there are all these kind of different ideas and classes and scams and inspirational sayings that are kind of floating around in these young girls' world.
Another one of the women that you follow pretty closely is Wu Chunming, and she shares her diary entries with you. Actually, it has some of these quotes from Benjamin Franklin, but there's a lot of self-deprecation and wishes to speak, you know, better herself, to speak Cantonese like the managers do, and also English. Now, she and Min both discovered there's a kind of a class barrier between the managers and themselves. And I wonder, do we have sort of success stories, the Horatio Alger story kind of among these migrant workers?
Yeah, I think both of these young women's stories, you could say, are success stories in a way because they start out on the lowest rung of the ladder, you know, making electronic parts or shoes for, you know, $50 a month and then moving up from there. And over time, Min ends up finding a very good job in the purchasing department of a factory. And last I talked to her, she actually had saved enough money to buy her parents an apartment in the city. You know, so that's in 4 years since she's come to the city. It's kind of amazing. And Chunming, she also started out on the assembly line, and over a decade, she sort of moved her way up into what I think of as kind of the proto-middle class. You know, she's got her driver's license. You know, eventually she hopes to get married and buy an apartment and a car and settle down in the city. So the trajectory of their lives is definitely upward. But interestingly, they don't really dwell on their success or their achievements that much. They're always focused on what's the next thing, what do I want next, what do other people have that I don't have. That's kind of that sense of no memory I was talking about. Everyone's just looking towards the future and the next thing they want to accomplish or acquire.
You write also about their relationships, both with men and with their families back home. Many of these factory girls want to marry. They have a dread of being, the Chinese word is aged youth, you know, people who are still unmarried, living home with their parents. How do they find mates?
Yeah, this desire to marry young, I mean, I think that's one of the ways in which the traditional Chinese ideas are still very strong. And at the same time, there's a very pragmatic calculation among women, which is, you know, if I'm young, my value is higher, so I'll get the best choices. You know, it's kind of tradition plus a very materialistic calculation. But, you know, it's a big challenge because one thing is that Dongguan, the city that I focus my reporting on, is estimated to be about 70% female because the many, many factories, the thousands of factories, prefer to employ female workers because they feel like they're more diligent and careful and don't get into trouble as much as the men. So that's one thing that's working against them is this huge gender imbalance in the city. And the other thing is just, you know, in the village, marriage is all based on, you know, family introductions or the local matchmaker. It's a known quantity. But in the city, they have to learn how to date, how to talk to strangers, how to make small talk, you know, how to introduce themselves, all these skills that they've never had to learn before. And one of the most interesting things in one chapter of the book, I followed Chunming as she went to a dating agency and sort of, you know, met men, and then I learned to do online chatting and flirting, went on blind dates, you know, and it was just really eye-opening because there was just so much, first of all, so much dishonesty. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone was lying all the time about their qualifications and their age, and you know, it was just, it was kind of like a replication of the work world. It was kind of very ruthless and very competitive, and again, you can only rely on yourself.
Well, your life and your family history are in the book as well. Your father was of Manchurian origin from a family that became quite powerful, and your grandfather, Zhang Shenfu, was assassinated and remembered as a hero. Now, why did his life make it into the book?
Well, it started serendipitously. I was actually on book leave from the Wall Street Journal and to work on this factory book, and I had some extra time, so I went up to my ancestral village in Manchuria in northeastern China. And I had known very little about my family history, basically that my grandfather, my father's father, had gone out from a poor farming village at the age of 16 to go to school, first in Beijing and later in America. And even though the family background, as you say, was quite different because he came from a very prominent family and he left the village for education, I felt like his journey actually had a lot of resonance and a lot of parallels to the journeys of these young migrant women. You know, that time, the early 20th century, China was kind of in a similar situation where it is now, kind of opening up to the world, trying to figure out how to be modern, trying to figure out what should stay Chinese and what should become Western. And my grandfather very much internalized these struggles and these questions, and he also had a diary that he kept over a number of years. So sort of tracing his story and his development through his diaries and, you know, Chunming's and Min's stories through their diaries and their encounters and the things I saw them going through, I thought was a very powerful way to tell the story of modern China. And, you know, as I said, Dongguan being the city of no memory, I really feel like there's so much history under the surface in China, and I didn't want to write a book that had none of that sense. So by bringing in my family story, I hope brought in this sense of the history that underlies the modern era.
Leslie T. Chang was for a decade China correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. We spoke to her when her book, Factory Girls, was first released. It's a work of excellent reporting and absolutely not fiction or performance art. There's a link to more at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a mobile health van brings care to teens in neighborhoods where doctors are scarce. That's when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR.